and he was living and in France. But I wanted to mention that first because that's a great scientist who died, and also because, in fact, although most of his great contribution concern pure mathematics, algebraic geometry, topology, category theories. In fact, some of his earlier work, known as Grothendieck theorem, concern, in fact, have a relation with physics. And there is a theorem called Grothendieck. I'm not sure I will write it. Grothendieck theorem that goes back to the 1953 when he was very, very young. And that's, in fact, it's a theorem about inequalities of norms in some vector space called Banach space. And in fact, it predates, well, it contains or had influence and the generalization of results called the Bell's inequality. Inequality, the CHSH inequalities, the Searle-Sons bound that you probably heard about in the quantum theory course, part of it. Okay, so which goes back to 64. Okay, of course, this was, he was not doing physics, but to show that sometimes the mathematicians are in advance of physicists, not always. Well, interestingly enough, in fact, 1953 is also the date where there was another theorem called Gleason theorem by a mathematician called Gleason, not of the class of Grothendieck, but that in fact predates by more than 10 years results concerning contextuality in quantum mechanics and what's called the Cochen-Speicher-Bell theorem. Okay, so end of this aparte. And now let's go back to, well, this has nothing to do with the course, but, well, except that it's quantum physics, which is an important point. And let us go back now to our good old and Earth-level quantization scheme of quantum field theory. So what I'm going to do today is continue the discussion of the structure of perturbation theory in the 5-4 theory. I told you at the end of the lecture, I explained you, and you probably have seen that already discussed in the QFT 1 course, that in fact, this perturbation theory, if you define it in a naive way by just taking Lagrangian, an action, making some functional integral quantization, and calculating things, you encounter singularities, divergences that are related, in fact, to the fact that the short distance behavior of our field, of quantum field, has a singular behavior that you do not expect in ordinary quantum mechanics. So this means that either the theory is sick or that you have to be clever in order to build a sensible quantum theory. So that's the program of renormalization that we are going to discuss more next week. But before that, let's discuss a bit more what's inside, what's the structure of perturbation theory. So again, I'm discussing 5-4 theory. For simplicity, I will be in the Euclidean formulation, Euclidean space. That's basically, in order not to take care of I factors and causality, et cetera, but that's a convenience for convenience. But all what I'm going to do will be performed also and valid in Minkowski spacetime. And so remember, my action is for this integral over spacetime, 1/2 of d phi squared plus m squared over 2. Phi squared plus g, the complete constant, divided by phi to the 4, phi 4. S naught denotes the free theory when g equal to 0. The complete constant g is positive. Okay, and We have seen that when we compute expectation value in the vacuum of products of operator in this quantum theory, it can be computed by a path integral. So I'm going soon back to the path integral, but before that, first point, I want to discuss a little bit the structure of higher order graphs or diagrams, let's say, diagrams, amplitudes. And the relation between this topology, the topology of the graph, and the order of perturbation theory. So that will be very simple consideration, but let us just remember, for instance, that in general, we considered, where is this in our theory? I had a nice little diagram. It must be at the end. My lecture notes, no, it's not here. Okay, in any case, remember, the path integral is defined by integral d phi, exponential. I am in an Euclidean setting, so no I factor, and I consider S to be the Euclidean action. I omit the E, but that's Euclidean action. Okay. And so the Feynman rules basically was that you have a propagator. And this propagator is given by the inverse of the quadratic form for the free theory. So basically, the propagator contains, if you are in momentum space, remember, I showed you that if you take the Fourier transform of the P, each propagator contains a P, and you have Hilbert of P squared plus M squared. But the important point is that each propagator carries a factor of H bar. Okay, and now, you have a vertex, interaction vertex. And each interaction vertex, which for the 5-4 theory is a point where four propagator meets, but for instance, for the 5-cube theory that you have discussed in calculated in the tutorials, it is a 3. So for a 5-cube theory, it will be this. This is 5-4. This is 5-cube. For quantum electrodynamics, this is something like that, et cetera. It's a vertex. So here, this vertex for 5-4, we go back to 5-4, contains a factor g divided by h bar, because there is a g divided by h bar in the, for instance, in the functional integral. Okay, so now let us consider a general diagram. For instance, a diagram that will occur in a four-point correlation function. So let me consider, I don't know, this is this kind of diagram, for instance. Okay, this is example, general diagrams. Okay. These diagrams will have, let us say, n external vertices associated to the fact that it's a diagram that contributes to phi n correlation function. It will have k internal vertices. That's because we consider the term of order g to the power k, because it's computed at order, the contribution at this at order g to the power k. And it's a number, and we, if the theory is defined on a lattice, for instance, it's a finite number. Okay. So now let's see. So it's a term of order g to the power k. So now let's see
how many H bars there are. So it is of order H bar to some power, let us say what X or M. Okay? And what is this M? There is one H bar per propagator. So let me consider this diagram. We consider it as L lines. Here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it has k internal vertices. Okay. So L equals the number of lines of the diagram. Okay. So now let us consider the quantity M plus N, which is the number of lines minus K, minus N. Okay. This is L minus the total number that we call V, the number of vertices. If now I count external vertices and internal vertices, are just vertices of the graph. Okay? So, and now let me consider that I'm considering a connected diagram. As we have seen, in fact, we can compute the contribution of disconnected diagram out of CCP, the products of the contribution of connected diagrams. Then I have just to find the theorem not to make a mistake. There is a famous topological theorem. Yeah, here it is. That's goes back to Euler, so that's the end of the 18th, the beginning of 19th century, end of the 18th century, which states that for a connected diagram, this quantity, L minus V, is 1 plus B, where B is what's called the number of loops of the diagram. And what is a loop? A loop is an independent circuit in the graph. See? So imagine that you have some electric flow flowing in this graph. So this is one loop. This is another loop. This is a third loop. And imagine that you have independent currents flowing along each of these three loops with different colors. You can check that by taking some linear combination of these currents. You can, for instance, build out what's going on if you have a current going here. Because you take the yellow loop minus the blue loop, and you get the violet loop. Okay. So I expect, if I have not made a mistake, I might have made a mistake, that this diagram has three loops. Okay, let us check that. And of course, this diagram, so let us check that. This diagram has, as we have seen, six vertices. This diagram has 4 plus 6, 10 lines. So what is L minus V? This is 10. So what should it? So this is 10 minus 6 equal 1 plus 3. Okay, B equals 3. That's right. Yes?
I'm not sure I get what counts as a vertex. I thought that there were 4 external vertices and 4 internal vertices. Right.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
So
that's 8.
Oh, I'm sorry. Why did I vote 8? So that's 2, and that's because I stated my theorem incorrectly. Thank you very much. Plus 1 equals 3.
I'm very sorry.
Yes. Okay. Okay. And basically, you can prove the theorem by stating that if you have a tree, something like that, if you have a tree, it's clear that the number of vertices is equal to the number of lines plus 1. That's simply the theorem that a stick has 2 ends, or a point has no line. And when you had a loop, in order to add a loop, you had 3 lines, because you cut 2 lines. Or, well, you can either you cut 2 lines if you do like that. Well, you can do that also like that. If you want to add a loop from 2 vertices that already exist, you just add to add 1 line. So each time you add 1 line to the tree, you add a loop. Here I have added 1 loop, 2 loop, 3 loop, 4 loops, etc. Okay. So what's important is that the factor of h bar, this factor m here, is equal to, as we have seen, L minus V, which is B, minus 1 minus n. So in particular, there is an h bar to the power B. You see. Plus some other things for such a diagram. So this means that, in fact, the perturbative expansion, is so that without at the beginning was an we formulated as an expression in power of the coupling constant, is in fact also a topological expansion, if you want, expansion in loops. So the higher the term in the perturbative expansion, the higher the number of loops of the diagrams are. Yes?
Why don't we have more loops in this diagram? Like, I could imagine going like this.
Why do we are?
It seems like I'm counting more loops.
Ah, you are thinking, for instance, about what? This one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this one, I think you just have to keep a linear combination of the 3 loops that I have been considering here. Because take this one, so take the
take the white one, no, the yellow one minus the orange one, and you get the one you are looking for.
What does that mean to subtract?
Well, that's because, consider this one. Let me draw the diagram again. I'm considering the yellow one, so that means that what I'm doing is this. I start from a point here. I do this. And once I have here, I decide to... I decide to go along... I see. So what you want to do is this one. You want to do this one. Yes? That's what you want to do. I didn't do anything wrong. I counted three loops. So I don't want to... Then you have to take the blue one minus the... No.
Blue minus orange.
Pardon?
Blue minus orange.
Blue minus?
Orange.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. I wasn't seeing the orange. I don't see the color. Yes. You take the blue minus the orange. Yes. So this is blue minus orange. Okay? I'm too close to the blackboard. Yes. Because then blue minus orange means that you start from that. And then I'm going in the other direction for the orange. So I'm doing this, and this. And this goes up. This goes down. So you get this. Yes. Yeah, I am too close to the blackboard. OK, so this is the perturbative expansion is also an expansion in the number of loops of the diagram. So often, instead of taking of perturbative expansion, one speaks about loop expansion. So that's a general expansion.
So
yes?
Usually, like when we've done a perturbative expansion, we've done it in G, not H bar. So you're saying that we should, is it more?
No, that's the same. So here you see first that it's a loop expansion. And second, you see that the perturbative expansion is also an expansion in H bar. Okay? So it's a semi-classical expansion. If you treat H bar as a parameter, compare it to the typical action in your problems, you are expanding in power of H bar. So the tree level is a classical level. What you are drawing by drawing three diagrams are just solving the equation of motion of the classical theory and expanding those solutions in terms of the coupling constant, because you are dealing with the H bar zero term, no quantum effect. And when you go further, you are considering the leading quantum effect, the subleading quantum effect, etc., as a power of H bar. Okay? Good. Oh my God. A bit long. Okay, any case. So that's important to remember this. So now I'm going to introduce the second point I want to treat in this lecture today, which is to make a systematic manipulation of Green's function, correlation function, by introducing generating functionals. And this will be, in some sense, just a tool to manipulate, in the mathematical, in the mathematical sense, all correlation functions in a single object. Yes?
Should it be, you wrote n as b minus 1 minus n?
Yes.
Plus n.
Oh my God, I made
M equal L. Oh, no, no, of course, it's plus. I'm sorry, I'm very. I'm in a bad shape here. Yes, sorry. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So, this will be just a tool, a mathematical tool, way to manipulate, to make calculation on all the correlation functions and not on each individually. And that will be, turns out, to be convenient later on. Okay, so first, remember, we started from a theory that was defined with this action as a functional integral. Let me call it Z, which is integral d phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi, where s is the action. Okay, so let me add to this action a term that I'm going to call g dot phi. And g dot phi will be just a shorthand notation for integral over whole spacetime of a function g of x times the field phi of x. Okay? And here, g of x is a classical, if you want, a classical function, namely a classical source term. So phi is associated to a quantum field because that's a variable we integrate over in the functional integral. G is just a function. So in some sense, it corresponds to add to the action a linear term in phi that whose amplitude may depend on the position in space. So it's called also in classical mechanics, in statistical physics, it corresponds to an external field. In statistical mechanics. Okay? And of course, if I had this big functional integral that I don't compute yet, becomes now a functional of G. You see? So this becomes a functional of G. G being a function of X. Okay? And of course, G is real here. Phi and G. Phi and G are real now. Okay. So it's what's called the functional, okay? And you can see quite easily that if you define the concept of functional derivation by defining that basically the derivative with respect to the value of the function g at a point x of g phi, which is a number, is just phi of x. Plus the ordinary rules of derivation. Then you see that if you make a functional derivative at n different points of this big object and divide by z of g and at the end set g equal to 0, what you obtain is simply that each functional derivative takes out, picks one of these terms, make the derivative of exponential of 1 over h bar g phi, which is phi of x times the exponential. So each functional derivative takes one of the phi here at the point x and put it down in the integral. You see? Up to a factor h bar. So what you get is simply h bar to the power n, the number of functional derivative, times the ratio of this functional integral with phi of x1 up to phi of xn divided by the functional integral without phi. And at the end, you set g equal to 0, so you get rid of that. So what you get is just the expectation value. So the correlation or green function in the vacuum of phi of x1, phi of xn. Okay. So you see that this functional, this functional of G, in fact, is just a compact way to manipulate all the correlation functions. So Z of G is called, and in particular, in now, if you expand Z of G in powers of the coupling constant or in powers of H bar, what you get is a sum of all diagrams of the theory, Feynman, the sum of the contribution of all the Feynman diagrams, simply divided by the sum of the contribution of the diagrams with vacuum diagrams. So this is, in fact, this is a, what is called the generating functional for all the diagrams and amplitudes of the theory. Okay. So I'm just doing nothing else than what I did yesterday. Simply, I am building an object that contains all the objects I have computed or that I should be able to compute with the rules of applying Vick's theorem and Feynman diagrammatic rules. Okay? Okay. And so you see, for instance, that the so this contains all the diagrams of the amplitude of the theory. So for instance, Z of 0 is a sum of vacuum diagrams. All the vacuum diagrams, they may be disconnected. Okay, and et cetera. Okay. Okay, so this is not very, you have to remember this integral, but this doesn't sound to be very interesting, except that now I can make formal manipulation on this object. So we have seen yesterday that, in fact, if you know the contribution of all the connected diagrams, you know the contribution of all the diagrams because there is some, you have to multiply them. Okay. So let us consider now the following object. Let us consider a new functional W of G, which is just h bar times the logarithm of this z of g. Okay, or if you prefer, write z of g as exponential of 1 over h bar w of g. Okay. And let us consider now, for instance, what is what is this object in perturbation theory, okay? So let us compute, for instance, delta W of G, the functional derivative delta over delta
g of x1, delta over delta g of x2, of w of g at g equals 0. Well, it's very easy from the definition that we get for this. We compute w of log of z. So when you take a derivative of log of z, we take the derivative of z of g divided by z of g. So you can check very easily that what you get here is phi of x1, phi of x2, minus phi of x1, expectation value of phi of x2. Okay, so this is zero in phi 4 theory. But in phi cube theory, for instance, this was non-zero. This result is valid for any s. So you get that here, in fact, what you get is a contribution of the sum of the contribution over all connected diagrams. Because if a diagram is not connected, if you had a diagram like that, and these diagrams exist in the phi cube theory, the diagrams are cancelled. Okay? And in addition, what is the power of H bar that you get with such a connected diagram? So we get a sum of a connected 2 points diagrams. And with a contribution which is of order H bar, remember we had above H bar to the power, where was it? I have to. So higher the power m equal number of loops minus 1 plus n. Ah, remember, there was a power oh, I'm sorry, this is a minus n here, of course, because then there is an h bar to the, there is a 1 over h bar, so it's a minus n. Here I had the power b minus 1 plus m, so the factor m that I called here, plus minus n, because each derivative is associated to the 1 over h bar, and W contains a factor h bar plus 1. So I get a plus 1. So I get a factor h bar to the power b minus 1 plus n minus n plus b. So I get a factor hb, number of loops. So with this factor h bar that I put here, I get rid of all the h bar associated to the external legs or to the I get just h bar to the power b. So that makes things more convenient. Okay? So for instance, for phi to the 4, this will be equal to the propagator with no factor h bar minus g over 2 h bar times these diagrams, since this diagram has one loop, one factor of h bar. Okay? Again, if I write d over dg of x4 for the phi 4 theory, what I get is, of course, I had a h bar to the power of minus 2. I get of w of g, I get a h bar to the power of minus 4, and then I get phi of x1 up to phi of x4. These terms are absent, but since I'm taking four derivatives on a log, you work out the things and you check that you get minus the contribution of the two-point function times phi of x3 times phi of x4
minus the same contribution, minus the same contribution obtained by permutations. Okay, so that's a straightforward calculation, taking what's the derivative acting on a log. Yes?
So the h bars that you put up in front of you, they're like in addition to the h bars you normally get.
Yes. Yeah, so in fact, that's what, in fact, I wrote it here, but I should have written it here too. Plus one, sorry. I should have it on plus one, so I get minus h bar plus one. So I get finally the sum over connected four-point functions, four-point diagrams, with a factor h bar to the power of b again. So for instance, in that case, this will be given first by g times this diagram with no h bar factor, minus g squared over 2 times the sum of these diagrams plus and f of this diagram plus those obtained by permutations, because these are the only connected diagrams at first order and at second order in G. And this is a term of order h bar because you have two loops. So you see that this object, W of G, is the generating functional of connected correlation functions. Okay? So this allows already many manipulations. And finally, I'm going to introduce another object which will look more abstract, but which is very important and will be very useful in discussion both of renormalization of scaling, which is called the effective or the quantum effective actions. And I'm first going to define it in an abstract way, and then show you why it's useful. So we start from this W of G. So I'm going to call this effective action capital gamma of some field phi, where phi will be a classical field, which is called the background field, which is on the same footing than G. So phi is a function, phi of x. So it's a function from space-time, let us say here, D, to the real number, or Minkowski space-time in the classical. Okay. So phi is not the quantum field that is denoted by capital phi. It's something else. OK, and how do we define this effective action? First, I'm going to start from W of G, this functional W of G. So it's a functional of the source function G. Let me take the compute the functional derivative with respect to G as a point X. According to this, this would be equal just to this object. So it's the expectation value of the field phi in the theory. You may say this is zero for phi 4 theory. This is zero if G is equal to zero. But here, I'm not considering that g is equal to 0. So this is a functional of g. Let me denote it as expectation value of phi for the theory with the source term not set equal to 0. Okay? And of course, that's phi at point x. So it's a for a given g, it's a function of x. So by definition, we take this to be the background field phi x. So you see that to any g of y, for y in space-time, so to any function g, there is a set of phi of x. But of course, phi of x doesn't depend only on g of y. Phi of x depends on g on all space-time, in principle. So phi of x, so if you want phi, so now we consider phi to be the function, the set of all phi of x for x belonging to space-time. So this is a function, classical function, and a functional of g. It's a function which the value at each point is a functional of the function g because it's a function of the value of the function g of at all the points together. Okay, so you have to be. So the mapping, basically, the mapping from g to phi is a mapping in the space of functions over RD, over my space time. So it might be a complicated mapping. In general, this mapping will not be well defined. It will not be invertible. But it turns out that we can discuss this mapping. It has nice properties, at least if we expand the action in the coupling constant. So in perturbative expansion, this mapping will make sense, at least in perturbation theory. Okay. So now, and so see, this function phi is just the expectation value of the quantum field in the presence of an external source term. Okay. So that's the definition of my background field. So now, I have a function null of the source term and a background field that is a functional of the source term. And I'm interested in expressing the things, the properties of the theory in terms of the expectation value of phi instead of g. Because in a quantum theory, if you make an experiment, if you want, I'm very abstract. I'm thinking about the theoretician experiment, the Gedanken experiment. What I have access to is, in general, is the expectation value of the field, not the source terms that may come from some physics complicated that I have no control on. Okay, so we want to express the properties of our quantum theory, in particular how our correlation function depends on the expectation value of the field. So basically, we want to make the change of variable and express things, properties of the theory, in terms of the background field instead of g. Yes?
Sorry, I just want to get my head around this idea of phi. Phi is mapping the space R to the d to the set of functionals on functions of the space.
No, the mapping from g to phi is a mapping from a space of functions to a space of function. You see? Because g is a point in the space of functions. Okay? So I have space. So I do not specify if these are continuous functions. But let us say, assume that there are some. So it's some space of function. Let us say c
the function over RD onto C over RD. Okay. So take this to be the continuous function, the infinitely differentiable function. I won't be that precise. Okay? Okay, so now if we want to go from how those things depend on G to how things depend on phi, this means that we want to consider the quantum theory, for instance, with a constraint that the expectation value of the quantum operator phi is fixed. Dealing with a system with constraint is something physicists and mathematicians do very well. It uses an object called the Legendre transform. So it's a Legendre transform of the functional W of G. And Legendre transform play a role in thermodynamics, they play a role in the study of the surface, the shapes of crystals as a function of the surface tension of the crystals. They play a role in many domains in mathematics. They play a role in the study of multifractals. So what is a Legendre transform? How is it defined? We start from the function W of G, and we define the object gamma as G dot phi minus W of G. Okay? And we consider that this object gamma is a function of phi instead of a function of G. So we make this change of variable, which means that we start from W of G, we define phi by and phi equal dw over dg. This has to be understood that phi of x is d delta w of delta g of x. So we define this function, and we make this change of variable. Yes?
Sorry, I'm still totally confused. The way you've defined phi up there,
yes,
as far as I can tell, like that requires an input of a j.
Yes.
So are you're effectively saying that, like, once I define phi, so I can
go back to G.
Go back to G.
Yes.
And then every G, I'm getting a different.
Yes. Rate. Yeah. Okay. So of course, the assumption here, I'm doing that. The assumption is that the mapping G to phi is invertible. And this is not always the case. But let us assume that it's invertible, at least locally. Around the point G equals 0 and for phi to the 4, phi equals 0. Because we have seen that when G equals 0, the expectation value of phi is equal to 0 for the phi 4 theory. So assume it's at least locally invertible, and we are going to be interested in two small variation. For big G, it may be non-invertible, but I'm closing my eye. Okay, so this is the definition of the Legendre transform. It's a mathematical object. Okay, and this object has nice properties. For instance, in fact, some properties of the Legendre transform. The main property of the Legendre transform is that it's what is called idempotent. What's the name of this? Ah. It's the Legendre transform. The Legendre transform is a function itself. So properties, we can rewrite this as W of G equal G dot phi, or phi dot G, let us say, phi dot G minus gamma of phi. That's a triviality. But what is not completely obvious is that G is equal to the functional derivative of gamma with respect to phi. Okay, and so it means that the Legendre transform of the Legendre transform of a function is a function itself. Okay? And in fact, this seems to be a bit miraculous, but it comes out simply from the property that the way you make a change of variable and you invert this change of variable, the matrix of the partial derivative of the inverted mapping is the inverse map metric of something. So it's just nothing mysterious. Nothing mysterious. It means simply that if I am mapping from x from some xi to some yg of the xi's, then d, so the inverse of the matrix this, and I take some element kl from this inverse matrix is just dxk over d, no, I'm sorry, of dyl. It's just a consequence of that. Okay. And this has a very, but this has an important consequence. Well, we'll see that it has some important consequence. Okay. So now I've introduced this object. This seems a very abstract object. Let us compute it. Gamma of phi at first order in H bar for the phi 4 theory. Okay. So for this, we first have to compute. So we start from z of g. From the phi 4 theory, which is a functional integral d of phi exponential of minus 1 over h bar, the classical action for a phi 2 theory, minus g of, and let me integrate this to be precise, integral over x, g of x times phi of x. Okay, remember this is a quantum field, if you want. It's a variable we integrate over. Okay. And let us compute this object, considering that h bar is very small. So if h bar, oh, I'm sorry, and there is 1 over h bar, and I'm computing this. So at zero order of h bar, what counts is the minimum of this function, which means the solution of the classical equation of motion of my theory when I have a source term, g of x. So let us call phi c of x the solution of the functional equation delta s over delta phi of x minus g of x equals 0. And for general y, let us say. So I have, I get the solution of this. Of course, this equation for phi 4 theory is just minus nabla, the Laplacian with respect to y plus m squared plus g over factorial 3. I'm sorry, this is minus Laplacian with respect to y plus m squared of phi of y plus g over 3 factorial 3 phi cube of y minus g of y equals 0. Okay, so I called phi c the solution of this equation. Okay. So call phi c the solution of this equation of motion. And of course, phi c is a functional of G, because the solution phi c depends on the value of G. And it's a non-local functional because the value of phi c at a given point x may depend on g at a different point y, because you have to solve a non-linear partial differential equation. Okay. But now let us, so this is a functional of g, but it's a classical object. Classical object. Okay. So now, let us write the general phi in the classical functional integral as phi classical plus some small perturbation, because this will be, it's a saddle point of the functional integral. Okay? It's the point that dominates, the value of the field that dominates in this functional integral. So now we integrate over phi, so better make a change variable to see the contribution of the variation of the fields that are close to this saddle point. Yes?
How can we see, is it just because if I multiply, sorry, it's just like I do some sort of integration of both sides of this, of the definition of both phi c, then I see that roughly goes to zero. And so the exponential would be about 1 and everything else.
Yeah, that's what you did in the tutorials. Yeah. That's basically the fact that you have an integral over z of exponential of minus a over 2 z minus z c, c squared plus term of order z minus z c to the power cube. This basically is proportional to, 1, well, if you have a function, let's say, if you have a function that you write as, that you locally linearize as a plus b plus I order term, and I'm computing the exponential of this function integrating over x, what I get is exponential of minus, well, let me have a, consider rather, well, a function f of z, and this is f of z c, this is the second derivative of the function f, this is the third derivative, and f prime of z c is equal to 0, then I have this expansion, so basically this will be exponential of minus f of z at the saddle point times a Gaussian integral, namely one half and then one plus term that you can neglect. Well, you have to neglect if I neglect those terms. Okay. So here I do the same thing. I write phi, which is a quantum object because I am integrating over. It's not a well, plus h bar one half times some small fluctuation, and integrate over the phi tilde, you see? Then by the same result, you get that what is z of g? This is exponential of minus 1 over h bar, the classical action taken at phi c, minus g times phi c. This is the contribution of the saddle point. Then I have the analog of, I'm sorry, minus one half of the contribution of the second derivative. But now this is a function, so this appears to, this will be a functional determinant. So what I'm going to get is the functional determinant of the operator second derivative of phi at time c to the power minus one half. And then I'm going to have higher order term of order h bar. Where, what does this mean? What does this mean? what I call in a very sketchy way second derivative phi of the action with respect to phi, in fact, is an operator whose kernel is the second derivative of the classical action with respect to phi when I make a derivation of phi at point x and the derivation of phi at point y. So it's an operator acting on functions whose kernel is given by the second derivative of the action. So this operator is called the Hessian operator. It's a generalization of for functionals of functions of many variables where it's called the Hessian matrix. And in this case, this Hessian has a very simple form because this is the form of the general form of the first derivative of the action. So what happens if we take the second derivative? We take a derivative with respect to this phi. So this operator is just the operator minus Laplacian, Laplace operator plus m squared. That's a linear elliptic operator. But then I have to take the derivative with respect to phi of phi cube. So I get a phi squared. So I get a plus g over 2 phi squared c and at point x. So this is an operator, well, no, let me practice. So this is an operator that is a linear differential operator times the multiplication of the function by phi 2 of c. Yes? You mean you are worried that it might be then an hyperbolic operator with at the level of, it won't be a problem at the level of those calculations because here I am doing algebraic manipulation. When you compute, you have to see whether this determinant exists, whether you have problems. But it's at the formal level, it's not a problem. Okay. Okay. And to be precise, if you want to be more precise, one has to be a bit careful. This is an operator. What does it mean? It means that, in fact, if I start from a function psi, another function, and let this operator acting on a function psi and consider the value of this function at a point x. This is minus the Laplacian with respect to x of the function psi at point x plus m squared the function of psi at point x plus g over 2 phi c squared at point x times the function psi at point x, because this is a linear operator at acting on a function. So one has to be careful. There is a phi square of c squared times psi of x. Okay. So it's a linear operator. Acting on function psi on my space-time. Okay. Okay, so that's a general, yes?
You haven't closed on your definition of Zj yet, but not a definition like this. The calculated value has a Zj.
Phi c, I'm sorry?
Of Z, Zg.
Yes.
The calculated value you have on the third line from the bottom on the right-hand side. You're missing a bracket.
I am griffing.
You're missing a bracket, like a right bracket. I'm not sure.
You are perfectly right. Oops. Yes, of course. Thank you. Okay.
Okay, so this, okay, so now from this, so it's important, and remember phi c is a functional of g. So in fact, this seems simple, but it's, you have to solve this equation. Write phi c as a function of g, and write this, where this depends on g, this depends on g, phi c depends on g, this depends on g, so it's a complicated function as a function of g. Okay, so now, well, let us compute, follow our rules. What is w of g? W of g is h bar logarithm of w of z of g. So, to first order of h bar, this is g times phi c minus the action for phi c and times the logarithm of this, and the logarithm of this is, and you can write that there is a h bar, so it's minus of h bar. The logarithm of a determinant of the logarithm of the determinant is known to be, at least for matrices, the trace of the logarithm of this operator. So let us write this. This is quite formal, but this is a trace of another operator, which is the logarithm of this operator, this Hessian operator, that depends on g through phi c. And then I have higher order term of order h bar squared. So this is w of g. Okay, very compact, but in fact complicated expression. So now let us compute what is the background field. What is phi of x, where phi of x is now the var phi in tech notation. So this is var phi, because it's a background field. Okay, what is phi of x? This is the functional derivative of w of g with respect to the variation of g at a given point x. Okay, and now, so we have a simple term that comes from the derivative with respect to g. So we get phi c of x plus terms that come from the fact that phi c depends on g. So this equation. So, and phi c depends on the value of g at all the points. So we have to take into account the value of phi c at point y different from x, because they may depend on g of x. So what we have to write is integral d of y of the variation with respect to phi of this term times the variation, so it's just the rules of partial derivative of a function of another variable. We get the functional derivative of phi c at point y when I change g at point x times the functional derivative with respect to phi at a point y of this object, g times phi minus s of phi minus h bar over 2 trace of logarithm of second derivative of s at phi. Okay, and let me check that I have checked everything. And this one, this object, I compute the functional derivative of this object considered as a function of phi. And at the end of my calculation here, it starts to be complete, I set phi equal phi c, where phi c depends on g. Okay, so this seems a bit complicated. So This seems a bit complicated, but in fact, there are a lot of simplifications that occur. And let me show you this simplification. There are simplifications. There are simplifications because phi c is given by the solution of the equation of motion. So, for instance, the functional derivative of this term is equal to zero at phi c. Okay? And so, what you get is that this object, phi of x, is equal to phi c of x. These terms become zero, so there remains only a term of order h bar. So I get minus h bar over 2, integral over dy, delta phi c over dg point y, times the functional derivative with respect to phi at a point y of the trace of the logarithm of this second derivative of phi for phi at phi, at phi equal phi c. And the important point is that these terms, which is in fact quite complicated, is of order h bar. So the background field phi of x is equal to the solution of the equation of motion with a source term up to quantum correction of order h bar. And that will be enough for our calculation. So now, let's go back to this and let us continue the calculation. Yes.
You've got d phi c of y by dgx.
Pardon?
Why should you have the phi c, like you have phi c, you know, the terms for one way?
Yes.
The d phi, should it be d phi c or just d phi?
I'm sorry?
Should this be delta phi of c or should it just be delta phi?
Delta phi c. No, this is the same than here. This is delta phi c of y divided. No, no, that's the same. I'm just rewriting this using the fact that this is zero automatically. Because at phi c, g phi c minus, well, the second derivative of g phi c minus s phi c is just, this is the object, is just g of y. I'm sorry, this is just phi of y. I'm sorry, this is just g of y minus second derivative of s with respect to phi point y at phi c, which is zero by the equation of motion. Okay. So, I have 10 minutes left, so I just have time to reach the important calculation, the important result. So now, I just have to perform the Legendre transform. So now I perform the Legendre transform. And I define my effective potential, which is a function of the background field here, as g dot phi minus w of g. But we have seen that We have an expression for W of G. Why is it? Yes, here it is. Function of G and phi C. And we see that now phi C is to leading order in H bar the same thing that the background potential. So we can rewrite this effective potential as the action of phi C minus G times the background potential minus the saddle point plus H bar over 2 trace log of the Hessian H bar. And use the fact that phi C is equal to phi up to term of order H bar. So we use the fact that phi C equal phi, I'm sorry, phi C, the solution of the equation is equal to the background field plus term of order H bar to expand, and that G is a function. And the fact that G is given by, remember, and G is equal to the second derivative. So it's given by, if you want, S prime of phi C, namely, because it's given by the first derivative of the action at phi C, to replace everywhere where we have a G and an S prime, W, we replace the phi C by phi. And you can check that if we expand phi C, if you use this phi C equal phi bar phi plus O of H bar, you will get, what are you going to get? We are going to get the action at point S plus a correction of order H bar minus G times a correction of order H bar. But G is given by this equation. So you can check that everything here cancels. So we can check that this term can be replaced by S for the background field. This correction cancels here because of this. Okay? And then it remains the term of order H bar with the trace of the logarithm of an operator, differential operator that depends on phi C. But replacing phi C by the background field doesn't harm because it will, there will be correction, but they will be of order H bar squared. H bar times something of order H bar. So there will be hidden there. So again, here we can replace this by the trace of the logarithm of minus of the second derivative of the action at the background field plus term of order H bar squared. So this is the explicit action, the explicit form for the effective action. This is the effective action at one loop approximation. Okay? And this result is very simple. We went through some details, but at the end, you find that the quantum effective action, so it's a quantity that refers to the quantum theory, it's equal to the classical action, hence its name. That's why it's called an effective action. So it's the action of the theory modified by the quantum effects. So this is a classical action, and this is the leading correction term associated to quantum effect. So it's all the H bar. And what is it? It's just the trace of a logarithm of a differential operator. That is the second derivative of the Hessian operator. You see? Okay. So that's a very nice compact formula. And in addition, you may note that, in fact, I never used the explicit form of the action. Well, to be clear, here I, for instance, wrote what phi c, how phi c is independent on g, but I never used that in the derivation. So this is a general formula. For any fields and any actions, so the phi, capital phi and bar phi, may be fields with spins, with etc. Provided that they are bosonic. Because we dealt with real numbers. It works for complex number. And complex for complex fields, one over h bar over two will be replaced by an h bar because they are twice more. But basically, for complex numbers. So it works for the scalar field theory, but it will work for gauge field. Fields that carry spin one. This formula is valid for Einstein theory. If you try to quantize it and look at its normalization, you have problems where you have to be careful with gauge invariance, but that's a very general formula. Except that for Dirac fields, which are non-anticommuting, therefore not described by real number, this formula has to be defined because you have to define what are fermionic fields in a proper way, what is the action, and in fact, it turns out for fermions, this plus h bar over two sign is replaced by a minus h bar, basically because this is the anti-commute. So for fermions, the h bar over two is replaced by minus h bar. That's a famous minus one sign associated to fermions. And the Fermi Dirac, the Fermi Dirac statistics. Okay? Yes?
So we've taken a, we started with a classical action.
Yes. Yes.
And we've rewritten it in terms of an effective action, but an effective action in terms of classical fields.
Yes.
That accounts for the
yes. Yes. Okay, so this is very abstract. What I'm going to do, well, in fact, on Monday, because I was hoping, is that now I'm going to show you for the 5-4 theory what it is. What is this object? Remember, for the 5-4 theory, I've wrote here this Hessian. This Hessian operator now as a function of phi is just a linear operator that depends on the background field. So we have to compute what is the trace of this logarithm, and the question is, what is, well, what are the objects, if you want, phi of x is the generating functions of, I'm not sure this sentence is completely correct in English, but you see what it means. What is gamma of phi at phi equals 0? What is the second derivative? Which objects are contained in phi c? And the answer is, this is a question, and we are going to see next time, just by an explicit calculation, that answer, the irreducible one particle diagrams. So there will be this diagram, this triangle diagram with external legs attached to, but forgotten about. These diagrams. So that's why this object, one of the reasons why this object is useful, because it allows to manipulate the basic objects that are contained in that form that built up the perturbative expansion in terms of Feynman diagrams that are the irreducible one particle diagrams. Okay. But we are going to see that next week. Okay, thank you.